The main message of this talk is that the first cosmological constant problem, that is why the cosmological constant is not on the order of the Planck scale, is directly solved in unimodular gravity, as has been suspected for some time. And in fact, this is not news. As I'll mention, I think in the way that I say it, Raphael here, who was one of the early people to work on this, knows this. The only thing that had to be done was show that the quantum theory corresponding to unimodular gravity has the same property as classical theory, which is decoupling vacuum energy in a certain way. And because of that, the key argument, which I'll try to take, because I'm very aware that I'm talking mostly to cosmologists who are not specialists in the details of gauge quantum field theory. The key arguments are technical but completely standard. And I'll try to take people lightly through those arguments and make the key conclusions. So my outline is to explain, it's been touched on before, what unimodular gravity is. It's a very old idea due to Einstein. Explain a reformulation of it due to Hanau and Teitelbaum. And then go through the technical argument, again, very much of a sketch, of a light touch, I hope, as to why it implies that the cosmological constant decouples in a certain sense from the gravitational field equations. Having done that, and that's the key result, if I have time, I'll talk about two other things. One is a hand-waving argument due to Jack Ng and Van Dam from some time ago that arguing in a hand-waving way about the form of the path integral that they guessed in unimodular gravity, there is a hand-waving argument not just for the cosmological constant not to be Planck scale, but to be of the same order of the matter density. And I'll show that hand-waving argument at the semi-classical hand-waving level is recovered from this precise story of the quantization. And then, and all of that is in a paper of a little while ago. And then, if I have time, I'll talk about new work about the Hamiltonian quantization, particularly because another aspect of unimodular gravity is that there is a global notion of time in it, which is hidden in general relativity. In fact, unimodular gravity is just another way of reformulating general relativity. The classical theory is no different, but it gives opportunities, perhaps, for making progress on certain long-standing problems in the quantum theory, having to do with the nature of observables, the inner product of quantum gravity, what to do about the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. I'm happy with the lights on, but you probably can't see the transparency. Okay, so that's the plan. So I want to thank NIOSH because my coming into this work came from trying to address one issue that his work that he talked about here raised, which is that there wasn't a Lagrangian formulation. And as a quantum field theorist, without a Lagrangian formulation, I can't move. So I wanted to make a version of NIOSH's theory that had a Lagrangian formulation. I ended up rediscovering unimodular gravity. And I also want to thank Raphael Busso, who at about the same time gave a colloquium here, about the same time that NIOSH first started talking about his work, in which he said that you have to take the anthropic principle and the eternal inflation landscape seriously because it provides the only solution to the cosmological constant problem. And I thought, boy, that's a challenge. So let's see if we can meet that. Okay, so just for, I think it was stressed before, there are several cosmological constant problems. The old one, why it's not enormous, why it has the value it has, and the coincidence problem. Unimodular gravity is just a reformulation of general relativity that Einstein first published in 1919. Then there was a huge gap, as far as I know, in which it was not mentioned till a paper of Tony Z in the middle 80s. Then there was a flurry of work until the early 90s, and as far as I could tell, until this year, when a couple of different papers appeared about it, it kind of died again. So
1973, I think.
I'm not a scholar in Euclidus. Okay, thank you. So what's the basic idea?
The basic idea in the simple formulation is to study general relativity but constraining the determinant of the metric to be a fixed density, a fixed non-dynamical density, which we can just call epsilon naught. And I plug that into the action, and now I have this action with an epsilon naught rather than the square root of minus g. If I think about it that way, the gauge group of the theory is reduced from the diffeomorphisms of space-time to the volume-preserving diffeomorphisms generated by vector fields that are divergence-free. Okay. Now, is that the same physics as general relativity? Okay. Well, it's easy to show that it is, with just a slight reformulation. The equations of motion, because you don't vary the square root of minus g, and that's fixed, are just the trace-free parts of what you're used to writing as the Einstein equations. And this is what Einstein wrote down in 1919. Those equations of motion have a symmetry according to which if I add to the energy-momentum tensor coming from matter, wherever it comes from, a term proportional to the metric itself, that decouples. That's subtracted out in taking minus one-fourth the trace. So the not the Lagrangian, but the equations of motion have a symmetry which decouples any contribution to the energy-momentum tensor proportional to the metric. In particular, those terms coming from quantum corrections of the form of a big, huge constant times the metric of space-time. So that's the idea. I think Einstein understood it, and a long line of people understood it. So why isn't that already? Why wasn't the cosmological constant problem acknowledged to be solved a long time ago? Well, let's go a little bit further, and then we'll address that question. And so here's our equations of motion. That's to see more of what the content of those equations are. Remember about the Bianchi identities, take the divergence of this, and you get an additional condition that the divergence of r plus t is zero. Since the divergence of that quantity is zero, let's give it a name, minus 4 lambda, plug that in, and you get the Einstein equations with lambda now a constant, because lambda is the name of a quantity which is constant. So the field equations are the same as the field equations of general relativity. The only difference is that the cosmological constant lambda is not a parameter of the theory. It's a property of the solution, or another way to say it, it's a property of the boundary conditions and initial conditions of a particular solution. So the space of solutions of unimodular gravity is the same as the space of solutions of general relativity for all values of the cosmological constant. So you have one more dynamical degree of freedom, which is the cosmological constant. The decoupling is still present because if you shift the energy momentum tensor, because lambda is a function of the energy momentum tensor, you shift lambda as well. So the decoupling is still present. So why did we ever talk about the problem of the cosmological constant problem? And I think the reason is encapsulated in this comment of Weinberg in his famous review of the cosmological constant problem. Weinberg, among other approaches, discussed unimodular gravity. So all this is nothing new, what I'm saying. And he said the key question for deciding whether this is a plausible, possible theory of gravity is whether it can be obtained as the classical limit of any physically satisfactory quantum theory of gravity. And that, I think, is the key point. This first cosmological constant problem has an H-bar in front of it. It's about the quantum corrections to the energy momentum tensor. And therefore, it has to have a solution in a theory with an H-bar that is in a quantum theory. It's not enough to say that you have a classical theory that solves the problem. Weinberg's worry, and he then spends several pages of his review to express his worry, is that there's no quantum theory of gravity such that unimodular gravity emerges as the effective equations of motion for the effective fields of that quantum theory. And he makes an analogy to the dynamics of the point particle, raises a bunch of interesting issues, and ends up skeptical.
Gravity theory does not solve the cosmological constant problem. It suggests another way of looking at it.
Right, right.
So his opinion didn't solve it.
Because the cosmological constant ends up being a constant of integration. But that's true. That's the second cosmological constant problem. Mm-hmm. But the first cosmological constant problem, okay, the decoupling of the vacuum energy corrections to the energy momentum tensor proportional to the metric tensor. If Weinberg sets up a question, if there is a quantum mechanical theory of gravity whose classical limit is unimodular gravity, then you could fairly say that the first cosmological constant problem is solved.
Sorry, I just can't resist. I'm actually looking at this, and he's actually saying that recent work by Hinault and Teitelbaum dated 1988 shows that there is a sensible general equivariant quantum version of the classical theory. So he accepts it.
Okay, great. Thank you. I'm definitely not a scholar, but my next section of the talk is about Hinault and Teitelbaum.
So this is the same review or the
same review? Same review.
Same review. Let me. I don't want. We can over drinks have the argument about history. Okay. The main point of what I want to present is that one can quantize the unimodular gravity at a level of constructing the path integral, and it is unimodular. So let me lightly take you through that. To take you through that, I have to introduce the Hinault-Teitelbaum formulation. Who knows? I do remember that they thanked Weinberg for introducing him to the problem. So who knows which way that conversation really went. They do a nice little trick. And I don't know if it's original to them or somebody else. But it turns out to be very useful. One way to say why this trick is useful is that if we have a new degree of freedom, if we have general relativity plus one new degree of freedom, what's going to happen in the Hamiltonian theory? Because in the Hamiltonian theory, degrees of freedom always come in canonical pairs. So what's the thing that's conjugate to the value of lambda? And that's what Hinault and Teitelbaum made transparent. So they introduce a new field, which is a three-form field, which up to one number is going to be gauge dependent. It has one number in this whole field, as you'll see. This is a three-form field. I'm just practicing with different notations. You can take the dual of this. I'm always in four dimensions here, although I'm not sure there aren't analogous things in other dimensions. Its dual is a vector density. D is a four-form, which gives us a scalar density. And they add this to the action. They go back to the action of general relativity, so no more is determinant of G fixed. They add to the action general relativity this new four-form, D of this three-form, times the scalar field, and they put the scalar field where the cosmological constant used to be. And that's the theory of Hinault and Teitelbaum. And it's a few steps to get back to the same thing. The Einstein equation, so here's the equations of motion. The Einstein equations have this field phi, where the cosmological constant used to be. But if you vary phi, you find out that the determinant, the square root of the determinant of g, is b twiddle, this scalar density. And if you vary the three-form a, sitting inside B is D of A, you find out that phi is a constant. And you get back to the Einstein equations with the cosmological constant having arisen as a solution of equations of motion.
So phi is a Lagrange multiplier.
Phi is like a Lagrange multiplier. So that's just another way of seeing it. And the decoupling symmetry is still there. Now, what's nice about the field A And I, again, Raphael was very interested in this a long time ago in the mid-80s and wrote about it. Bill Unruh wrote about it. I don't know what exactly the history is that because D of A is the square root of the term of the metric is a nice interpretation. Take a region of space-time R, say in a spatially compact universe, bounded by two space-like surfaces, sigma 1 and sigma 2, then the integral of the freeform A on the second surface minus the integral of the freeform on the first surface is just the space-time volume in between. So what this field A is doing is giving you a notion of time, which if we fix the initial conditions, its integral over every three surface gives the four volume to the past of that three surface. So I'm going to call that physical time elapsed or four volume elapsed. And this is the quantity which is conjugate to the cosmological constant. Okay. Now here comes the pedagogical challenge. We'll see how well I do. I want to make a claim about the quantum theory. I don't want to. It's the last talk of the conference. It's the last talk of the day. There's a technical argument to make, and let me mention the steps, and then I'll rely. You can tell me. I'll rely on the audience for if any of you want to see any of this. If any of the audience want to see any of this, probably even if most of you are cosmologists, probably you took a course on quantum gauge theories at some point, and you ran into the Fedeev-Popov procedure, where you constructed the path integral for the quantization of the gauge theory. And what you did is you went through a convoluted chain of steps, which let me just list them. You started with the classical action of your gauge theory. You worked out the Hamiltonian formulation. You discovered that all the gauge symmetries are generated by constraints. And that's still true in general relativity, where the gauge symmetries are primarily the diffeomorphisms of the manifold. You gauge fix them to get you a phase-based description, which was deterministic, had no gauge ambiguity or gauge freedom in it. You constructed the path integral for that fully gauge fixed evolution in the phase space. That is, then you did the standard construction from Feynman of the path integral quantum mechanics in that fully gauge fixed form. Okay, and that's where Fedeev-Popov came in, although it was done first by Bryce DeWitt, but independently a little bit later by Fedeev and Popov. You worked backwards from this messy object to get a form of the path integral in the configuration space. That is, you integrated out all the momentum kind of variables to get a path integral in the configuration space so that it looks like the integral over e to the I times the classical action plus a whole bunch of other stuff having to do with gauge fixing and so forth. And I'm not going to mention BRST, but BRST is a different path through the same swamp. And then you construct the quantum effective action for average fields. The question is the resulting quantum effective action unimodular? If so, the decoupling symmetry is present quantum mechanically. And the answer is yes. Okay. Anybody want to see any of that? So what I have to present is formal. And that is writing at the level of Fedeev and Popov and so forth. But formal, non-perturbative, and then one can argue formally what will be the properties of perturbation theory. Okay.
Action?
Yes.
Do you mean modular or?
Yes. Yes. You know what, I think I don't hear a great desire to see this stuff. So let me just point, there's the Hamiltonian formulation, there's some new constraints that don't come up in general relativity. There's the constraint algebra, there's how you get rid of the laughs. There's the, I can pause here, and for people who will recall something about this, the canonical variables are the free geometry and its momenta, which is related to the extrinsic curvature. Plus you have this new field A, the free form, and its conjugate momenta P, A there, and A there are four-dimensional variables. Instead of the Hamiltonian constraint, which is hidden in the A0 plus the matter part, you have a new term with the P0 in front of it. So this is an interesting structure. The P0 is the momentum conjugate to the free form A. And you have a new constraint, which is the derivative. There's no cosmological constant, but there's a constraint that says the derivative of what used to be the Hamiltonian constraint is zero. So there's a slightly different structure than we're used to in general relativity. And now you do the path integral quantization. You go through all those painful steps I talked about. Here's the first step, and here's the last step.
In the introduction of A and its conjugate
form. Yes, yes, yes. And in particular, just to back, in case that people who know the language, the Hamiltonian constraint has the momentum conjugate to A0, to A0, that's the time-like component of A seen as a four-vector in front of it. And this is just, everybody here should just be eager in expectation of this turning into a d by dt, okay, which I'll get to. That is indeed going to turn into a d by dt.
Okay.
It's not directed to the universal, but I've always been confused about the time that they have talked about the procedure in gravity, because as you know, you don't really have a gauge group. I mean, because of the way that the Hamiltonian constraint works.
Nonetheless, as Fadeev and Popov did, in fact, Fadeev and Popov, for people who don't know, were quantizing gravity. That was the main aim, and their application to Yang-Mills theory, which has become so important, was done as a toy example, because there was no application of Yang-Mills theory for physics at the time. But so that was sort of the gift of quantum gravity to the world. Let me point out that when you're done, you have a path integral over space-time metrics. Okay,
the Einstein-Hilbert action, so that's just what you would get. The details of the gauge fixing today, a Popov thing that Raphael is asking about, and we can talk about offline, but has been understood for a long time. And the new thing is there's a delta function that says that the determinant of the metric is fixed in terms of some fixed density. That came from a gauge fixing of there's a gauge invariance where you can take the A and add A prime is A plus B of some two form, and it came from fixing that gauge invariance.
This root minus G equal to epsilon naught. That violates diffeomorphism invariance.
Well, this is a gauge fixed pattern.
How can you get BRST invariance, which is a basic gauge invariance problem?
I have not looked into BRST invariance, but this is a gauge fixed path integral already. This full the path integral in the continuum is always gauge fixed, it's fully gauge fixed.
No, but this is not gauge fixing. This is violating diffeomorphism.
This is a consequence of, so the short version of the story is that there's a lot of extra gauge symmetry in the formulation of Hanau and Teilhard, because there's only one number sitting in this three-form field, which is the elapsed four-volume. And so there's a huge extra amount of gauge symmetry, which is this, where A is a three-form. And fixing that gauge symmetry, which you have to do too
in the Fadeev-Popov procedure, it works out beautifully. And the only thing I can do, because I didn't believe it would work out, is go through the details, and the gauge fixing for this requires that you invent some density, because the dual of A is a density. is a vector density, and it just all comes together like that. And if you were a room full of experts in the quantization of gravity or gauge theories, I would walk you through that, but I'm not going to torture you. But yeah. It's all stuck up here in the Today of Popov determinant. And there's an extra factor of the determinant of the metric that comes out, which experts can scratch their heads over. Okay. What is what?
Oh, psi is the integral over the matter fields. There's matter in the theory, so psi is whatever matter fields are. Okay. So the claim is
that Weinberg's challenge is met. One can go some steps further and construct, which I'll do on the next slide if people want to see it, and construct the effective quantum action for the average expectation values of the quantum fields. And it is indeed unimodular as a result of this delta function here. So there is, at a formal level, because these are formal path integrals, a quantization of gravity which has a classical limit or a classical effective action, which is unimodular. Okay. So that's the main result.
What I mean by unimodularity is that the determinant of the expectation value of the quantum field, so I'm jumping ahead, people who know this stuff will know what I've done, that this has determinant one in a fixed coordinate system, because I'm completely gauge fixed now.
So everything depends on the expectation rates that they have. Because
it's... let me take an optimistic attitude towards it, okay? The quantization of general relativity may or may not correspond to nature. Okay? But unimodular gravity is just general relativity rewritten a different way, so that the cosmological constant becomes a parameter on the space of solutions rather than a parameter in the Lagrangian, which is for that's all it is. It's just general relativity. One might claim that any successful quantization of general relativity has to solve the first cosmological constant problem, because any quantum theory of gravity has to have a classical limit that reproduces big universes where general relativity is true, whatever it is. And if you have a cosmological constant of Planck scale, you don't have a classical limit at all, so you don't reproduce classical general relativity. So what I would claim from here is that if you want to quantize general relativity, maybe you don't, but if you do, you should quantize the theory according to the unimodular formulation, because then you cancel that term. If I wanted to be really provocative, but I'll save that for somebody else in the audience to do. There's even more provocative things to say than I
can say. So actually, what you said was the statement of anthropic principle, I think.
No. What I said was a statement of adequacy, that is, there's a list of candidate quantum theories of gravity.
Okay.
We don't actually care if the right theory comes from quantizing general relativity or any of 12 other things.
Sure.
Okay. But what we do care about is that the theory has a classical limit, which has big universes in which general relativity is.
But isn't the classical limit defined by humans?
No. Okay. It's defined by theory universes which are much larger than the Planck length. Okay. We're skipping the details. Okay. Now, if everybody has been happy to skip the technical details of the main claim, now we're going to do a hand-waving argument. Okay. And I don't. This argument is not at the level of the first claim, but it's one that everybody can understand in 2 minutes. And I just mention it for the amusing value of it. And maybe somebody will tell me it's all wrong. Okay. This argument really comes from Jack Ng and Van Damme in about 1991. They conjectured that the path integral for unimodular gravity would look like the path integral for general relativity with the cosmological constant integrated over the cosmological constant. Didn't have to be.
Okay, again, you can go from the precise definition of the path integral of the Hanau-Teitelbaum formulation, and you can actually step by step come to this. Okay, so this is the same quantum theory that we've been discussing. they're, you know, Raphael mentioned something about being lucky, whatever. They're really lucky. I mean, there could have been huge measure factors here that could have been, it just happens to be the case. So then in the semi-classical approximation, this is dominated by the stationary phase points, which are classical solutions of this. We want the phase not to run around. There's an I there. Again, this is, I'm hand waving furiously. Therefore, this should vanish on solution. T is the trace of the energy momentum tensor. I use the equations of motion. I replace R. There's a relationship between R, lambda, and T coming from the equations of motion. I plug it in. And this is the relation I get. Then I wonder what to do with that. I ask Nyesh, who has a friend who knows that there. So something that came up in Aaron's talk is, how come there's no Lagrangian formulation for the perfect fluid? Well, it turns out there is. Some friend of Nyesh, whose name I'm forgetting, has written notes about that. And from that, you learn that the Lagrangian is proportional to the pressure. So I neglect that. And I end up with a statement that at a hand-waving level, my path integral is dominated by histories in which the cosmological constant is related to the average energy density in the history of the universe. And that looks a lot like what Aaron was saying. And I'm not going to defend it too strongly. But it's amusing. And if something like this could be done beyond a path, a hand-waving level, it might be interesting. However, to do that beyond a hand-waving level, we would actually need to be able to have control over measuring things in quantum cosmology. So the scene of the crime of an awful lot of stuff of speculative contemporary theoretical physics is that nobody knows how to do quantum mechanics correctly at the level of cosmology. And there's a contributing factor to that, besides the fact that we're all dumb and misguided and whatever, is that we confront the Wheeler-DeWitt equation where time, quote, has disappeared, and we start wondering what the hell, how do we construct an inner product on the space of solutions of it? An inner product is supposed to be related to probability conservation. That's its physical meaning. It tells you what's conserved in time. But there's no time, so what does the inner product mean, and how do you pick it? And okay, so to make more progress about that, I turn to loop quantum gravity, which is a subject where you can make precise statements and get precise results about canonical quantum gravity. I'm skipping, for those spin foamers in the audience, what I'm just skipping was for you. That is how to make unimodular gravity in the Plobansky formulation, which is what you need to make spin foams, which is what you need to make path integrals rigorously defined and regulated and so forth. But I have like 5 minutes, so I'm not going to do that. That's for the experts who could work it out for themselves while they're whatever. Okay. So the last part of this is new. I'm taking advantage of the fact that this is a workshop. And what I want to do is, I'm aware that there are not mostly non-experts here, so people don't know the ifs, ands, and buts about loop quantum gravity. So let me mention the key facts I'm going to use, and then basically make a claim that there's interesting research to develop, which uses the fact that this A field picks out a physical notion of time and general relativity to possibly address the problems of time, the meaning of observables in classical and quantum gravity, the choice of the inner product, and so forth. This is a program of research. Okay. So in loop quantum gravity, the good news, which is old news now, is that the Hilbert space of spatially diffeomorphism in invariant states of general relativity coupled to matter is precisely defined and known upwards and backwards and rigorously and left and right and so forth. On that Hilbert space is defined an operator which measures the volume of the universe, assuming, for example, it's spatially compact. That's a finite number. And that operator is known rigorously upwards and backwards. There are versions of the regularization of the Hamiltonian constraint, which are precisely defined. Many of us don't like the ones completely on offer because of the issues I discussed, but there are precise rigorous results about their existence, ultraviolet finiteness, and so forth. So now I can work in a context in which I'm not just writing down formal statements with integrals over infinite number of fields in them. The key open issues that I mentioned include the inner product on physical states, the physical observables, the issue of time, etc. And what I want to suggest is that maybe the fact, so unimodular gravity seems to address very nicely one kind of quantum gravity problem. So, and then it has this other feature, and which it has this preferred or physical notion of time, a kind of natural proper time for a whole cosmology, which is the four volume in the past. And can we do that to transform hard problems, i.e. the problem of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which has no time variable in it, into Schrodinger-like problems, which have time variables, using a time variable. And this dovetails nicely with Raphael's talk. I think Raphael was the first person to get excited about this and try to do this. And from a path integral point of view, Raphael and colleagues have done a lot of work in this direction. And but so I don't know if what I'm going to say will be new to them. 3 minutes. Great. Okay. So since this new field A is a time, let's call it T. It's a scalar density. Let's call its canonical momentum pi. The four volume elapsed is the integral. They have canonical commutation relations. There is, in loop quantum gravity, a gauge field and the frame field, which have canonical commutation relations. There are wave functions, which now become functions of T, as well as the gravitational field, represented by a connection. And the Hamiltonian constraint now looks like a Schrodinger equation. There's a d by dt, which is where that p0 used to be, ih bar. That sits in front of something that is the determinant of the metric. And then sitting where a Hamiltonian would be is some quantum operator representing the what we used to call the Hamiltonian constraint. So that's the news right there. This just repeats that and reminds you that there's another quantum constraint, which is the quantization of the constraint that says that the thing that represents the cosmological constant is actually a constant. So there's a second constraint to be quantized. Otherwise, the cosmological constant would be a field. Plus, there's spatial diffeomorphism invariance and SE2 gauge invariance. Okay? Now, to address those issues, we go to the spin network representation in the 2.1 minutes that are left. For the non-experts, quantum states are represented by networks. Which represent parallel transport of the space-time connection. And the thing that you need to know is that the volume or the determinant of the metric is only non-zero at the nodes. Particularly at nodes which are valence 4 or higher. And what that means when we follow a well-worn path that I don't have time to review, to go from the space of states as functions of the connection to the space of states as functions of the graph, is that we get something like a Schrodinger equation. And just to explain this equation, and then I'll just draw some conclusions from it. What I do to regulate that equation is I partition space into regions, one node in each region, and then I have the elapsed four volume of each region is a new degree of freedom that lives at the nodes. So the states have new labels which have to do with the elapsed time living at the nodes, and there is a Schrodinger equation for each node, and it's preceded here by the volume of that node, the contribution to the volume that node makes. So the proposal is that these are what replaces the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And it just fits beautifully into the spin network representation because these time variables land beautifully on the nodes, one per node. So, and I see Niyash is standing there. So let me just say in words
to define the solutions of those simultaneous equations, which has to do with defining the conjugate energies
at each node, which are really the cosmological constant in waiting, and going to the space of solutions to the time-independent Schrodinger equations that correspond. And when you're all done, you have an explicit formula for writing down the physical state space, the space of physical solutions, and the physical inner product. Okay, so I think I have to end, but let me just summarize. Okay, let me just summarize conclusions. Unimodular gravity can be quantized via path integral, and the resulting quantum theory described formally by path integrals is also unimodular. Therefore, the first cosmological constant problem is solved in this context. Indeed, given that this is a very old framework, the problem never existed in this framework. Okay. The why so small and coincidence problems, you can imagine addressing. There's a hand-waving argument due to Ng and Van Dam. Maybe it's worth reviving in a better defined context. There is a physical time coordinate, elapsed four volume. The Hamiltonian quantization can be carried out. And this gives a new direction for investigating the knotty issue of what's the physical inner product in the case of quantum cosmology, what are physical observables, et cetera. And what I skipped over is that the path integral can be constructed in the language that people use for spin foam models. And therefore, there is work to be done to take those formal statements that I'm referring to here, which are formal constructions of path integrals, and make them completely finite, explicit statements for spin foam formulations of quantum gravity. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Questions for me?
Let's see.
The why is a small problem. So I think I understand. So what is the mass scale that has the cosmological constant to be affecting now?
The relation that comes from hand-waving stationary phase is the same one that Aaron talked about, that lambda over g goes by the average of the energy density through the history of the universe.
At the average of the energy density. So it's not the effect before, because the so it should be always affected.
Again, to make sense of a statement in quantum cosmology, you need a really well-defined thing. Look, this is an audacious statement. Okay. This is saying that quantum mechanics, that you're in a statement zero, you're in a theory where the cosmological constant is not a parameter, it's a feature of solutions, and you have the whole set of all the solutions for general relativity in it. Okay. Audacious statement of the year or the decade or whatever, it's quantum mechanical interference acting at the scale of the whole history of the universe that picks out a cosmological constant of the scale given by the physical matter density in the history of the universe. Okay, totally audacious hand waving, but it's an opportunity. It's something, in my view, to be investigated in the context of a serious, well-controlled approach to the quantum theory. A serious, well, for example, so you can ask precise questions in a really, you know, a precise observables in a quantum theory of cosmology in a precise inner product Hilbert space, et cetera. So that then set up the end of my talk where I point out that there are some opportunities for doing that, which have been long nascent because of the existence of this global time coordinate and maybe are now worth investigating.
Something I don't understand.
There's a lot I don't understand.
You end up with big G mu minus lambda G mu plus T mu. Lambda is the constant integration. So it can be identified with the bare cosmological constant, which is just a number. So if I write lambda effectively with the lambda naught plus delta lambda, Why is your constant integration protected from these?
Because my constant integration in the quantum theory is the expectation value of an operator, which is the expectation value of R plus T in some state. And if I have some T is T0 plus H bar delta T, then the expectation value of lambda shifts by the expectation value of H bar delta T in a way that cancels that term.
You know, I mean, just one comment first, actually. I don't disagree with any of the technical statements you said, especially in the first, what I understood in the first part. I think that's fine.
That's very generous, given that I didn't present any details.
Actually, the thing is that it's not unknown, because there is actually a paper by Buchmüller and Norbert Dragon from 88, who actually did the BRST formulation of this and calculated the Gauss and Gottfried Popov and so on and so forth. So it's been known in a very detailed way.
Okay. Tell me about that later, because you're better than me. I looked for it, and I asked a number of people, including Mark Cano, was this ever done, and everybody came back, no, so thank you.
It's been done, but in the point is, it's not, I think it's good to invoke it and to remind people of this issue, that, you know, general relativity is unimodular gravity theory.
Thank you, yes.
All right? But I don't think that's the solution to the cosmological constant problem. And here is why. Let's forget about, until in fact you demonstrate how to calculate that integration constant as in fact an expectation value of an operator in a given state. In a semi-classical theory, that's just an integration constant, it's a number. Okay. It is completely true that, you know, what you're basically saying is that what you call cosmological constant is the sum of the classical free integration constant and a quantum expectation value of some trace of stress energy tensor. The thing is that if you want, and you're also saying it's possible to choose that integration constant such that it leaves you with a flat space or as flat as you like it. Mm-hmm. The problem is that when you actually calculate the expectation value of the trace of stress energy tensor of the matter theory in this background, in the loop expansion, you will find that it continues changing order one, after every inclusion of a quantum correction in the matter sector. Mm-hmm. And so as you go, step after step, you have to keep changing and choosing.
Step after step, H right. bar mm-hmm. plus H bar squared, delta.
Not H bar, these are all divergent terms which are unidominant. And so they're all really ordered.
So I gave a formal argument that to every order in H bar, the shift happens.
No, you have to change the constant of integration to accommodate.
No.
Oh, yes, you
this
do.
This is where the fine tuning comes in.
Yes, you do. Now, admittedly, okay, if you come up with an argument which tells you this is an expectation value, which gives you a choice.
I made a different statement. The statement that I'm making, which may or may not be the solution of the problem, but is a property of the theory I discussed, is that any term in the expectation value of the energy momentum tensor to any order in H bar and cutoffs proportional to the metric tensor is not a source for the field equations for the expectation value of the metric tensor. That's the statement that's true.
I think I disagree with that.
One last question on the, not anymore. So, okay. So, I have one quick question, Rafael, it's quick.
So, in the classical theory and then in the semi-classical theory, you showed there was one time variable. But people objected at some time, in particular throughout movement, so that's not enough. You need this many different times. And then when you translated everything into the spin network formalism, it seemed like you did get the many fingertips. Did you actually change something, or is there some miracle happening there? I mean, you now have many times.
There is. Okay. So at a given in the quantum state representing a given quote moment of time, okay, there is a total invariant physically defined proper time or four volume elapsed to the past. Okay. That on a spin network state is partitioned amongst the nodes. Okay. I didn't have time to show, but the partitioning amongst the nodes, that is the assignment of a time variable to each of the nodes so that they add up to the invariant thing, okay, is gauge dependent. One can partition them differently to the nodes, so it's precisely representing the many finger time. The many finger time is still there. And I don't know if this would make Carol happy or not, but since we're referring to past history that other people here don't know, we can discuss that later. But the many finger time gauge invariance is of course still present. That is the part of the diffeomorphisms that don't change the four volume and just divide it up differently in different regions of space is still present.
The Higgs potential is a classical potential.
It doesn't matter. It is classical or functional. I'm going to insist on the actual results. The interpretation, we can worry about that. The cancellation happens classically or quantum mechanically to whatever order in H bar.
So thank you very much, and thanks a lot, Lee. And thank you. Let's thank all the speakers.